Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews. A chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the entertainment world. My guest today is indeed a musician, but he is likely better known, or unknown, for his work behind the scenes as the lighting expert for many other bands. It is a great pleasure to welcome Mark Rubenstein of Pig Light Show to the program. Mark, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, as you said, I'm a musician. I started out playing guitar and singing and wanted something special for myself way back when in the early mid-60s. So I started doing a little bit of light show for my band. And then, as things would have it, about 1967, I saw a real light show, Joshua Light Show, with all of the blobs and the slides behind, and thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And by that point, I had started getting more work for my lighting than for my music. So the transition to be a full-time light show, even more than stage lighting, was a ball, because that way, instead of just supporting the band, I was playing with the band, but in light, on a big screen behind them. And within a couple of years, I was pretty well known all around the New York area, and I became friends with Joshua, who was became my mentor. And when he decided to leave the Fillmore East to go into TV, I was his hand-picked person to fill in for him. And I took over the Fillmore and was there until it closed, and then started at the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey with John Scher. And, gosh, worked with pretty much everybody I could imagine except for Jimmy, Janis, the Beatles, and the Stones.
You mentioned you're a musician. I believe your band is called the Grey Lions.
Yes, it is.
Would you have any objection to me sharing a tune from the Grey Lions?
Not at all. The CD has actually just been mastered, and it should be coming out sometime around November, I think.
Okay, well, why don't we listen to Lost My Woman?
Hold my fun.
I think that's a great track. Why, tell us a little bit about the Grey Lions. Who are they?
Okay, the Grey Lions, for the most part, are me. I play guitar, sing, and I write all the songs. A friend of mine, John Light, who I knew since high school, is the bass player. We grew up in Long Beach, New York together. He now lives in Philly, and I live in Maine. And up here in Maine, I have a drummer, Jim Landry, and he sort of rounds it out. And then when we go into the studio, my producer is an old friend of mine, Mark Hudson, and playing with Mark is a ball because he'll add every instrument in the world, sing 90 tracks behind, and we just have a ball. And I guess it shows because it's all fun. You know, I need to get a sense of that out of it. It's just a ball.
How long have you been the Grey Lions?
Well, we formed about 2 years ago. It was actually, I had not played for a number of years because I was doing other things and raising a family and all of that. And about 2006, my mom went into hospice care, and I was living down in Florida in her apartment and then visiting her in the hospital every day. And I, you know, it was sort of a very tense, sad situation. And I needed something to keep me going because I was in her house, but sitting with her, you know, knowing she was dying. And I went to a local music store, George's Music, down in West Palm Beach, and I picked up a guitar. And for the next few weeks, while I was in my mom's place, I was playing more and more, and I found that I just was happier. I was going through this whole thing with my mom dying, but deep down inside, the playing every night really just evened things out for me and helped me get through it. So after she died, I started getting more and more back into the music, and that led to getting back into the light show as well. Because in my mind, the music and the light show go together. You know, light shows, just music and light shows just work. You know what I mean? You can sit there, an audience full of people staring at a big screen, listening to music, and you don't have to worry about if, you know, people are dancing and singing on stage because you're listening. And I think that was the great thing about, you know, concerts back then, is people weren't worried about performing. They were worried about playing their damnedest. And, you know, doing the light show gave the audience something to stare at while Eric Clapton did his best on stage, you know, or whatever. And it was a great synthesis, a great symbiotic relationship. So when I started getting back into the music, the light show came with it. And during that time, I went to a rock and roll fantasy camp just to play with people again, because here I live in Maine, and I didn't really know that many musicians around. And I went, and I met Mark Hudson. I was in his band, and we had a ball. I started finding all of these people that were, you know, the counselors at the camp were people I used to play with. So I felt at home. I played with Jack Bruce and Roger Daltrey from the old days, Joe Walsh. I played with him when, you know, it was the James gang. He tried to pick up my first wife, as a matter of fact. But that's another story. And, you know, it was just like coming home. I got to teach Slash how to play Born to be Wild. That was just a ball. It was a lot of fun. And Mark kept saying, do you have any music you used to do? And I said, yeah, I used to write stuff. Lost My Woman was one of the things I wrote back in the early 70s. And I sent him a CD with a bunch of stuff. And he kept sending me emails saying, you got to call me. You got to call me. And I'd say, yeah, I'll give you a call. Finally, New Year's Eve of that year, he sends me an email that says, no, you don't understand. You have to call me. So New Year's Day, I called him, and he said, you know, I can be a real bastard, right? And I said, yeah. He goes, do you want to know what I really think? And I said, okay, I'm ready. He said, I loved it. I play it all the time in my car, on my iPod, all the, and I'm like, oh, wow. And for the first time in like 20 years, right after talking to Mark, I wrote a song. A year later, I had written 137 new songs, and now it's up into the 200 and something range. And most of the CD is newer things, but there are two or three old songs from the 70s and early 80s before I stopped doing musical things. And as I say, the big thing is that it got me back to light shows, too. And the last few years playing with the Electric Prunes and the Blues Magoos and meeting up with all of these people from my past, it's been a ball. You know, I'm sitting here at 59 feeling younger than I've been in many, many years. And a large part of it is just being into music again.
Oh, well, I mean, 59, that makes you an old fart along with me.
Well, I'm older than some dirt, but not all dirt.
I mean, your resume that Billy sent me reads like a who's who of great bands. I noticed the Grateful Dead, for example.
Right.
But they were renowned for their light show. I've got to admit, I'm not a deadhead.
Right.
I got nothing against their music, but undoubtedly, it was the entire ambience of the concert that that made them great. Was it the light show? Or, was it something pharmaceutically induced?
Well, Ozzy did tour with them a lot. So there could have been a lot of pharmaceuticals. But, the big thing about the Dead was I also was not a great Deadhead, but I enjoyed working with them. They were great people. I loved the guys. And the thing is when they play, it's a party. No matter when, no matter where, when the Dead play, it's a party. And even if you don't love the Dead's music, you're in a party and you cannot help but enjoy yourself. And, that's the thing. You get there and you feel part of something. And I think that's something, how can I put it? A lot of concerts today are in huge places with lots of sound and lots of lights and lots of people. But very often, the band is about, a mile away and they look about a quarter inch high. And what are you there for? What are you watching? At least in the old days with the Dead and everything. Before, finally they started doing bigger and bigger tours after Woodstock as well. But it used to be much more intimate in being with the Dead or any band. God, being in a small theater or with Mountain, with Cream, with The Who, that was intense. And, we used to, like at the Fillmore, you had a Friday night and Saturday night show, two shows a night. So we were pouring music out and three bands for each show. And the whole theater was, 2,500 people. In comparison to what you see today, 10,000 people arenas and or more, the shows were much more intimate. And it was incredible because you could see the people. You could hear from the stage the musician. You didn't have to hear the sound system, but you happened to have the best sound system in the world because it was designed for that theater. There was not a bad seat in the house. The guys who did the sound made sure that every single seat in the house had good sound. And, today, depending where you are, the sound guys are doing their damnedest, but, it's hard to make an arena sound good. And I think things have just gotten too big and too spread out. And that atmosphere of party, the Dead are the only people that do, and it's because the Deadheads bring the party with them. you know, and that's how I feel.
You've worked with many famous bands. You mentioned several, but I mean, you've also worked with Jethro Tull, the Allman Brothers. You know, who was your absolute favorite?
Oh gosh, that's a hard one. Because being a musician, I loved so much of it. And the great thing about Bill Graham and the Fillmores, both East and West, is he would put together the most eclectic groups. You'd have the Preservation Jazz Orchestra with, I don't know, Frank Zappa. And, you know, there would be such a mix of people that everybody that went started getting used to many different types of music. And I had favorite people, I guess. You know, working with Tull was great. Working with Steely Dan, I'm still friends with Elliot. He'll hate me. Elliot Randall. And as a matter of fact, with Jethro Tull, he does these things called couch jams that he puts on YouTube. And just a couple of weeks ago, he did one with Martin Barr from Jethro Tull, the original guitarist. And he and I were chatting over the internet one day, and he said, how would you feel about doing a light show to the couch jam? I have a friend here in London who does green screen, and he could put it behind me, and you could add the light show. And I said, that would be a ball, you know, because so many of the people that I knew are all over the world, and it's hard to really keep in touch with a lot of them. And this way, he and I and whoever he gets as his guests could put together these little few-minute videos and put them on YouTube and, you know, sort of get to work together without having to travel thousands of miles. And I think in a lot of ways that's been outrageous because I'm constantly in touch with people from my past, people from Long Island when I grew up. Tim Bogart just became a friend of mine. He was with Vanilla Fudge, Cactus, Jeff Beck Bogart and the PC. I worked with them with all three of those bands. And, you know, that was another great thing is that a lot of the people I'd meet would keep growing, keep changing. They'd get into new bands. I'd get to work with them. If you were at the Capitol Theater or the Fillmore East in those days, you saw everybody. And working there, that meant I got to work with everybody, and that was just outrageous. And I think a big thing is that if you're a lighting guy or sound guy, you're really helping the production happen. But if you're doing a light show, you're actually performing at the same time as the groups are performing. You're with them on stage, maybe on a screen, but you're a performer, and it's a much different position to be in. I've been a lighting designer. I taught lighting design for many years. I've lit hundreds of concerts, but doing the light show is different. There's a different vibe. It's much more like being the musician. And being a musician, I can tell you I know both sides of that coin.
it's a long, complicated story, which I won't bore you with, but Sam and Joyce Moore invited us to a concert. Sam Moore, as in Sam and Dave, except there's no longer Dave. And we were backstage way before it started, and Joyce gets up on stage, and she's just haranguing the sound guys. You know, now remember, louder isn't better. It's just one of those priceless moments.
Well, there are a lot of those.
Right.
Boy, have I got a lot of those.
The lighting world, has changed in the past 40 years. I'm guessing the disco ball is definitely a thing of the past. What do you use today?
Well, actually, I use exactly the same stuff I used 40 years ago. A few years ago, like as I was telling you, when I got back into the light show and my mom had died, I built a light show studio over a garage that I have. It's 26 feet by 30-something feet, and I put a rear projection screen in, and I got a bunch of overheads and slide projectors and mirror boards and just all of the same types of things I used to have. I do the liquids. I do everything I used to do. But what I do now is I videotape it, break it into smaller clips, then I'm able to play with those clips, multiply, let's say back in the Fillmore days, I might have had a couple of slides up or just a screen with, let's say, blue light, and then I'd have a circular mat with a liquid, a blob going in the middle of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, today I can take that same blob and put it on 20 times. I did a thing last year, San Francisco Music Tech Summit, whatever, and I was talking to the people there, and I showed them a video clip that I had done for the Electric Prunes, and I stopped at a moment, and I said, do you see that effect? That effect in the old days would have taken 32 people to do, because there was something like 15 overheads, and they were moving and this and that, and I said you would have to have one person moving the projector, one person doing the plate on every one of those overheads. Here, I make it once, I copy it, I, you know, use a couple of programs to create it multiple times, and sometimes they flow in and out of each other. So I have, the technology has given me an ability to do what I would do anyway in many, many different ways. I guess it's sort of the same type of thing. I used to argue with people all of the time in the early days of synthesizers, where they'd go, oh, you know, this computer music, it's going to take away jobs and this and that. And I would hate to count the number of keyboardists who play a lot of synthesizer who disagree with them because they're always working. But the difference between...
I know several. I've interviewed both Keith Emerson and Rick Wakeman.
That's who I imagine those are the two people you would have said.
Yeah. I mean, Keith Emerson still has his original Moog.
Yeah. And that was the thing. Those things were built like tanks. They lasted forever.
As opposed to the Hammond organs that he loved to destroy.
Yeah, well, axes and knives and tipping them over and all of that don't help the organ a lot. But at least he used to use the smaller Hammond, so it wouldn't fall on him and hurt him or anything. But
right.
The guts were the same as the B3. It's just the body was smaller, so he didn't
yeah.
kill himself.
He tended to not use explosives. That was probably a good thing.
Yeah, but then he was pretty explosive. You know, I remember the first time I saw him with Nice, and he was just awesome. And the energy, you know, it was, oh, God, I still play Rondo. And it's just incredible because he was always a great keyboardist, and he had energy for days. And no matter what group he was in, you know, any of the changes, you know, it was incredible. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, it's sort of like Nice with steroids, because even the music got bigger. You know, the people got, it was amazing, and it grew with the times. As the size of concerts grew, the sound he had grew. And, you know, it was amazing. It was just, but I think that that's the thing that people don't get. Because of the times, because of the musicianship, this was a weird time in music where, unlike Tin Pan Alley, unlike the 50s and early 60s with the pop top 40 hits, for a while, in mid-60s to the mid-70s, before disco, you had an era where people actually got the credit they deserved for their musicianship. It wasn't a popularity contest. People actually listened. You bought an album, and you listened to the album as a whole piece of work. You read the album cover over and over. I remember Stevie Nicks telling a story how she used to bring an album home, sit it down, and just go through it over and over, reading everything, listening to every song in order. And, you know, thousands of people, I talk to them now, and I say, okay, what was the song after such and such, Nights in White Satin or whatever? And they'll tell you, oh, it was, you know, whatever. I put it up on my Facebook page as a status, the poem that comes right after that, and I forget what the name of it is right now. But, you know, everybody remembers sequence. Sequence meant something. When you had Tommy come out, it had to go in a certain order. It told a story. And,
right.
You know, you don't have that today. Today, people buy music by song. Not by album, not by group, by song.
Mm-hmm.
You used to buy a Beatles album when it first came out, not knowing that three of the songs were going to become hits, but later you would have groups come out, and I can't remember the record company now, but Heart, they had one album where every single song on the album was used by the record company as a single, so that by the time they were done with them, you know, and the record company had, what, 12, 15 hits, and they had them written like crazy, but people were starting to buy by song, and that wasn't even the digital age. I think from disco on, nobody listened to an album. They listened to a song, and it was just like Tin Pan Alley, and it was just like the 50s, 60s, top 40. And, you know, that's part of the problem with music today is that all the record companies are looking for the next Hannah Montana, the next Britney Spears, we want our shot at it, as opposed to we want a great musician. So the indies get the great musicians, and the record companies try to gain back glory, and then they lose money left and right.
Okay, I'll tell you what, Mark. How about we do some more, Mark? It just ain't enough.
Ah, okay.
are you up for that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I wrote it. I love it.
I don't really care at all about how you're gonna pay. No, it really doesn't matter to me. I put up with you all these years. It's time for me to go when you really gotta know it's just a bit too late. For tears. You swear you wanna save this. But baby, you can do everything you can do, and I still have to say, it just ain't enough. If I'd gotten that even half, I would have accepted that. But you didn't even give me half, and all that comes in now is that. Now I really gotta go, and you really gotta know, to say I need a lot more than just half. You swear you wanna save it, you beg me to just hang tough. But babe, you could do everything you could do, and I still have to say, it just ain't enough. It just ain't enough. Sometimes they don't stand a chance. Sometimes you try and you ask yourself why, then turn away without a backward glance. It just doesn't matter what you're feeling or what you wanna say. I don't really care at all about how you're gonna pay. You know it really doesn't matter to me. I put up with you all these years. It's time for me to go, and I really gotta know, it's just a bit too late for tears. You swear you wanna save this, you beg me to just hang tough. But babe, you could do everything you could do, and I'd still have to say, it just ain't enough.
I'm a lot like the BBC in that I don't you know, ascribe to having commercials on my program.
Right.
But, all right, we are going to do something absolutely shameless. You know, where can people, or when can people find this CD, and do you have a website or 85?
Well, the CD will be available through iTunes and Rhapsody and everything else online probably in early November. The CD itself will be available soon after. The website, which I have to redo, that's a long story, but within a couple of weeks, by early November, it will be ready. And that is basically the Grey Lions, don't forget the, .com. And you'll be able to probably get the physical CD through there as well. And then as many record stores and whatever as I can get to pick them up. <It's available. laughs> But thegreylions.com. And,
now, that's gray as in G-R-A-Y.
Yes. That's sort of a double entendre, because we, the guys in the band, are all gray-haired, and I live in Gray, Maine. So, we're the Gray Lions in multiple ways.
Okay. The your company is known as the Pig Light Show.
Yes.
Where did that name come from?
Well, it actually weirdly comes from seeing a concert with Frank Zappa. it way back when the Mothers of Invention were still young, there was a little theater in New York on Bleecker Street called the Garrick Theater. And they were doing nightly concerts there. It was a little place upstairs from the Club Agogo. And I think it probably had about 78 seats. It's a tiny theater. And the cool thing is that meant that you were right there with the musicians. The place was tiny. And I was sitting there with friends waiting, and Zappa, being his inimitable self, is sitting there tuning, and, you know, we're whispering in the audience, and he goes, "Shut up, pigs, I'm tuning." And you know, he kept doing that through the show, "Shut up, pigs." And, you know, I was a high school kid. I went back and I started saying, "Shut up, pigs," to people. Within a week, I got known as Pig because of that. The light show was actually named St. Elmo's Fire. And I thought, you know, it was very clever, you know, because of the phenomenon. But everybody was calling it Pig's Light Show. And I finally gave up. I called up one of the vendors that I used in New York, and I said, "Hi, this is Mark Rubenstein from Pig Light Show." And they'd go, "Big? No, Pig, like Porky, Pig." "Oh, okay." But the next time I'd call a business, it was so unusual that they'd remember me. So it worked out in a lot of good ways, and you know, the only time it was a little weird is we did a summer series on CBS called Comedy Tonight. And CBS was, how shall we say, a bit tight. And they wouldn't allow us to say Pig Light Show. So instead of the credits saying, you know, Light Show by Pig Light Show, because we were on every week, they used us as a segue the same way Laffin used to use that little wall with the opening doors and people saying jokes through it. They'd use the Light Show to segue from skit to skit. And instead of just saying Light Show by Pig Light Show, it said, "Under the direction of Mark Rubenstein, blah, 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 blah," and it listed everybody in the show. And it's all because they didn't want to say Pig, because the police might take offense to it. Then again, they had a pilot out at the time that happened in a condominium, and they didn't put it out because their test group said that most of America might think that that's a birth control device. That was the brain power at CBS back then. So
I'm not sure it's changed.
you may be right there.
Oh, okay.
Although I think Fox has that brain set now, so I don't know.
Okay. How do you arrange the lights and effects for a band?
Well, usually I really have nothing to do with any of the lighting or the set other than somehow making sure that either a front or rear projection screen is included and that we have access to be able to see the stage while we're doing the show. Usually it's some other lighting company doing the lights, and this, from the 70s on, you started having light companies, they started using the moving lights. And within a few years, by the end of the 70s, early 80s, people were calling the stage lighting light shows because there were no real light shows still working, and they thought that was cool. But then you had more and more bands just pumping smoke into the air and moving lights around to the point that, you know, I have pictures of concerts where you cannot see who it is on stage. So what are the lights there for if you're not highlighting that person, that group? And at least when we do the show, I'll work with the lighting designer on the show or the tour or whatever, and we focus, instead of on smoke and tricks, we get lighting on the band, off of the screen, but on the band, and therefore they are much better lit, and we have the light show so that we have, you know, sort of the big visual plane. But the band gets better lit. I did a little video that I put together out of pictures for Slash and Ozzy, showing them the difference between a typical thing and what I was suggesting. And I think it's really cool that I just use cutouts in front of the light show, and I faked stage lights coming on and off. And, you know, it's not great, but it's cute, and it gets the idea across. So that, other than that, as a consultant, I don't really have much to do with the sets and lights the band travels with. But then again, sets and all become much less important, and the music becomes more important. And I think that that's something that's become a problem, where you have groups that are touring with huge set pieces. And why? If you have a group like the Stones, well, yeah, but they're playing on stages that are 200 feet across. And, the closest person to them, literally the closest person to them, is 30 feet away, because they have to have all of the barricades and this and that, so that most of the audience are hundreds of feet away. And the sets provide something. You know, a lot of times they'll have some video. But then, are you seeing the live act, or are you seeing the live act on video? You might as well be watching it on TV. And but if you do something like ZZ Top, now, I love the guys, but it's three guys standing on stage playing. And, yeah, they used to have the cute thing with the guitars that spun and, you know, all of that. But for the entire concert, there's three guys on stage playing. And should they be worried about getting, you know, sets? They traveled once, I remember, a tour where they actually had cattle. You know, tons of set stuff. And they literally had cattle on stage with them. But, you know, is that really necessary? Did that help the music at all? No, it was a distraction. They had to worry about, how are we going to impress the people next? Jethro Tull, during the Thick as a Brick years, I think it was, had a tour that was so big, they had to have three copies of it because they couldn't get it set up in the arenas the day of the show. They had to send a truck to the next city while they were doing a show in one city, and another truck would be going to what the third city would be. But they had to have three entire copies of the set, the lights, the music. And, you know, most of Jethro Tull stood there playing. Ian Anderson jumped around. But what was all the sets and all of that for? You know, if you're Madonna and you're dancing, you know, maybe you need a lot of that. But if you're a musician, the people are theoretically coming to hear you play and sing. They couldn't care if you're dancing with sets. And I think it's gotten to the point where we don't have concerts for concerts anymore. Concerts used to be a thing you went to listen to music. Now it's like live productions, except it's not, you know, a production. A theatrical event has a story, has a script, has a beginning, has an end. You know, there's a through line. If you're going to a concert, you shouldn't have to worry. Crosby, Stills, and Nash shouldn't have to worry about more than getting it right, singing the songs well, and
having everybody
lay there and go, oh, wow. You know?
I have to break in just for a second.
Sure.
We're about to lose our live listeners, but don't worry. Everything is being recorded, and it will be available on the replay. I have a great DVD, and I love it enormously. It's a Genesis concert that was recorded in Italy. I believe the title is Live in Rome. I have never seen anything like it before. It's a multimedia event. You don't even need the music. I can't imagine how much it costs to put that together. Have you seen that one?
I don't know that I have, but something you said really, you don't even need the music. Well, then what the hell? You know, and that's the problem, is that sometimes they're worried so much about this huge production that it doesn't really matter who the band would have been. Where if you go back to old Genesis with Peter Gabriel and the costumes and the, or Arthur Brown with his, you know, the burning hair and, you know, where, or Alice Cooper, David Bowie, where they were performers where the performance was part of the musical act. Having Alice Cooper be electrocuted, having them be hung, those set pieces were important because it was part of the story of their show. But if you went to see 10 years after, you know, did you need that kind of thing? If you went to see Genesis in the later years, you know, if you have all of that, it's cool. But like you said, you didn't even need the music.
Oh, you certainly didn't. I mean, I was just, you know, my mouth was open, my tongue was hanging out. I'm going, wow. How did they do that?
Right. Well, when I was teaching and when I went to college, and I used to have a lot of professors. My scene design professor used to say, if they go out humming the scenery, you've done something wrong. And everybody has seen a show or something like that in their lives where the lighting, the sets, the costumes was so great, but the show was, you know, so... If you're going to a live performance and there are other things that overshadow the performance, why did you pay money to see that particular act? And, you know, when you think about the amount of money that have been put into, quote, productions like that, where city upon city, it's like going, it's like Las Vegas Live, where, yeah, the show is about the spectacle. And it doesn't really matter who you put on that stage because the spectacle is the show. But when you turn around to Phil Collins and Mike and, you know, and you say, guys, you know, I'm sorry that this prop piece is 20 times your height and everybody in the audience could see it, but nobody can see you. But it's the show, you know. Didn't you come to see those guys? You know?
Well, okay, what is your favorite light show of all time?
I'm not sure what you mean. The favorite light show I've done, favorite group to do a light show with, or...
Both of those. You know, the favorite... most, you know, the one you had most fun doing and the one that most impressed you.
Okay, that's hard. Strangely, we did, as I said, I'm not really, you know, I'm not big into the Grateful Dead. However... we did the first set of Dead at Midnight shows at the Fillmore. The next sets were done by Joe's Lights, which were the guys from Joshua, without Joshua. But the first set, it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday nights, and it started at midnight and usually ended about 7 o'clock in the morning.
Incredible. Oh, God.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the Dead. They play forever. But it was 7 hours of party for 3 days, and it never felt like more than a couple of hours. You know, the music, I knew the music, I enjoyed the music, but it was just so much fun. The shows, you know, over 3 days, it was something like 20, 21 hours worth of music, and it felt like it just didn't last long enough. And that's not even music I'm really, really excited about. But I have to say I guess the most impressive, and it's not because it was the best, but it was my first vision of a real light show, and I always remember this. Before the Fillmore opened, there was a theater across the street, the Anderson Theater, and Josh White, who ran Joshua Light Show, and a couple of people he was in business with were, if I got the story from Bill Graham's biography correct, they sort of did it to show him how a show in New York, as opposed to the concert style of the West Coast, the ballroom style, how a show in New York could be run and could be run, you know, profitably. And they did these shows at the Anderson Theater, and it was the typical what later on became the Fillmore lineup. Three groups, a light show, two shows a night, and the one I saw first was opening act Moby Grape, second act Procol Harum, and third act was Buffalo Springfield and Joshua Light Show. And it was the first time I'd seen a real light show, and it was so cool. They had a revolving stage so that one set of equipment would be set up under the light show platform backstage while the other group was playing, and the interval between groups was literally no more than like 5 minutes. And it just was the first time I had seen a concert like that, with a real light show, stage lighting that was colored and done for the music. Shows like that used to be like Murray the K, where there'd be like 10, 12 groups. Each one would play like two or three songs and be hurried off. And, you know, that's the way rock concerts in New York were before. From then on, you know, things changed and concerts were very different. And even the theater that became the Fillmore, back then it was the Village Theater, even their shows were the same type of thing, where you would have three groups. And we got used to that format. And that format worked out fabulously. And, you know, later when the Capitol Theater opened after the Fillmore closed, John Scher kept the format. And it was really neat because you would have different types of acts. You know, you wouldn't have three blues acts in one night. You wouldn't have three, you know, progressive rock acts in one night. You'd have a mixture of things. And it was always eclectic, and it was always fun. I remember one night, I can't remember who the first group was. The second group was Miles Davis. And the third act, the star act, was Laura Nyro. And the people who were there for the first act and the third act were probably not ready for Miles, but they saw a jazz great at his prime. This was when Bitches Brew came out. And, you know, they would otherwise have never experienced that. But they got to, and they suddenly had a whole new vision of this whole jazz that they never would have listened to on their own. And I think that was great, where today they package concerts in such strange ways where, you know, you might have three acts that are all pretty much the same with different people in the bands. And I've seen some that are just horrible. And,
indeed. Mark, I hate to do this, but my automated producer is whining in my ear. we're just way out of time. Mark, I really want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Okay, and I do hope we can talk again.
Well, I would love to, and if you have my email address, if you send me an address, I can send you a little light show disc, you know, with a few songs and stuff on it with the light show, and you could enjoy... What's the modern
I would enjoy that a great deal.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
until next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a wonderful day, and try and avoid people like me and Mark. I'll talk to you all again soon. Goodbye.